I think the role of journalists is to always reveal the truth and to always document what's happening, regardless of the noise. And I think that it's important to be steadfast. It's important to have integrity and to keep doing our jobs, more important than ever, frankly.
It's How to Be Amazing. I'm Michael Ian Black, and I am excited to speak to my guest today for a variety of reasons. Not only because she is a genius, as certified by the MacArthur people who determine such things, but because I am interested in the power of bearing witness. I'm curious about what its power is. I'm curious about what its purpose is. And I'm also excited because we have never had a photographer on before. How to Be Amazing this is our first, and we've got a good one for you today to discuss all of these things. Lindsay Addario is one of her generation's preeminent photojournalists, covering wars and conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Darfur, among others. The bulk of her work is about bearing witness to the world of women, whether it is how they lived under the Taliban pre and post September 11th, women in India, women in Sudan, women here in the U.S. of A. Her photographs have appeared all over the world, most often, though, in the New York Times. She is the author of a memoir, It's What I Do, A Photographer's Life of Love and War, and a gorgeous new collection of her work, simply entitled Love and War. Lindsay Addario, welcome to How to Be Amazing.
Thank you so much.
So right before we were having a little pre-show banter, as you sometimes do, and you were saying to me when I asked how you are that you're angry, and you said that's hard for you. Why is it hard for you? Is it because you're slow to anger, or it's a difficult emotion for you to process?
No, it's not a difficult emotion for me to process at all. I'm just generally not an angry person. By disposition, I'm really happy, and I wake up very positive every day. But I think what's going on right now, I guess the main issue is we have a president of the United States who consistently says that journalists are enemy of the people, fake news. He has incited attacks against journalists, and it's really hard when I've spent the last 20 years risking my life to tell stories, to document, to be there on the front lines of not only conflicts overseas, but also starting to cover issues back at home. And we have a president who doesn't respect journalists and journalism, and it makes me angry.
When a leader, and it may not be the leader of this country, but of other countries, disputes facts, and your job is creating facts, what is the power of that disputation versus the power of the evidence that you as a journalist are able to provide? And do you see that line being crossed here?
Yeah, I mean, I am used to working in countries where authoritarian countries where whoever is in power lives in an alternate reality and makes up facts consistently lies, creates sort of an alternate truth. But it's never happened in my lifetime that my own president is doing that. And so I almost don't know how to handle it because I just can't believe, you know, almost every day there is a list of statements that he says that have been proven wrong. So I think more than ever, we have to rely on the importance of journalism and the importance of journalists who check the false facts that are being put out. And I think, you know, if you look at right now, what has sort of consumed me over the last few weeks is the killing of the Saudi journalist Khashoggi, which happened in the Istanbul consulate, because President Trump's first reaction to this was, well, I trust the Saudis and I believe whatever they say. And it was the role of journalists who really, really kept this on the table and who provided facts. And Turkey, of course, President Erdogan, who slowly leaked information about what really happened. And now we're in a situation
Erdogan.
No friend of journalists, but I have to give him credit here. I mean, he played this very well, and he is the reason why, you know, there might actually be some semblance of justice for a journalist who was lured into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and, you know, for as all evidence points, has been chopped up and while he was still alive.
The thing that I struggle with these days is, as I said in my introduction, the role of journalism to me, and photojournalism, obviously, is to create a set of facts from which we can all operate. Sometimes those facts or stories have to be adjusted to accommodate new information, but in general, we trust the press, at least the press as a kind of collective, to move stories forward in good faith, to uncover and report what is true. When truth itself becomes a matter of dispute, does the role of the journalist then change? Must it change or must it remain the same?
I think it must remain the same. I think the role of journalists is to always reveal the truth and to always document what's happening, regardless of the noise around us. And I think that it's important to be steadfast. It's important to be to have integrity and to keep doing our jobs, more important than ever, frankly.
When you, Lindsay Addario, get a telephone call and it says, "Hey, Lindsay, we'd love for you to go cover a conflict in X country. I'm just going to, let's say, some Central African country somewhere. I'm just sort of being hypothetical here." Mm-hmm. What happens at that point?
Well, immediately I make the connection in my brain as to who I know that has recently been there. That's often, you know, more often than not, I've been doing this for over 20 years. So I know I have colleagues who have worked pretty much all over the world. And so I start to make phone calls. I do some research. Of course, I pull up all recent articles and read about what's going on at that point. And I look for a local journalist or a fixer, as they're often referred to work with me on the ground, because ultimately that person will be the one who is my eyes and ears and who helps me get access and who helps me stay alive. So I think, you know, I essentially do a lot of research and make a lot of phone calls and have conversations trying to set up how to go about pursuing whatever assignment it is safely.
That person, that fixer that you're talking about, that's generally going to be, I imagine, somebody that you've never met. And that job interview, depending how it goes, could cost you your life. How do you go about vetting that person? Is it literally like somebody vouches for them?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, there is a community of not only photojournalists, but foreign correspondents who cover tough stories all the time. I mean, and so it's a very tight-knit community. And we have essentially vetted an incredible group of people around the world. And so it's not really a job interview. If I have someone's name, he or she has very likely to have worked with one or several of my colleagues and has already been vetted.
You said you've been covering, and you have been covering, these kinds of tough situations, as you just described them, for over 20 years. Are wars and conflicts, when you're living in them, when you're experiencing them day to day, how are they different from each other, and how are they the same?
So I think the biggest sort of realization that I had and that I've come to from the last, so let's see, let me just back up. I started photographing in 1996, but I started covering conflict in 2000. So it's been almost 20 years. And I started with women living under the Taliban and then covered the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan and went on from there. But I think the biggest realization that I had and that I've come to as a photojournalist is that nothing is what it seems from the outside. So, for example, I look at countries that I am assigned to go to, and I get scared because I say, oh my God, there must be bombing 24 hours a day and the entire city is decimated and it's run by insurgents. And then I get there and I realize sure, that might be happening, but it's generally in a very small area of the city. And so life goes on outside of that area, and the markets are open, or people are on the street, and there is an area of safety generally to fall back to. So I think that that doesn't necessarily come across on the TV reports or newspapers, because we're often focused on what's happening to civilians and the bombing and collateral damage. And so we don't focus on the fact that life is going on outside of that. So we are in part to blame, but I think it's very different generally on the ground from what it looks like on the outside.
It's kind of hard to imagine that somebody who's never been in that situation where you have, I guess for lack of a better word, a front line occurring a mile or so in away from where there might be markets open, as you said, and all of it sort of these battles existing in a very small contained area where terrible human misery is occurring. But in the wider world, sort of just outside of that, there is life and activity and people going about their day.
Well, I mean, I think the main thing is the unknown. You know, it might be quiet. And for example, I was just in Yemen. And so it might be quiet in Sana'a. And then in the evening, you hear aircraft flying overhead. And then you hear sometimes an airstrike, but it's often in the distance. And the real fear is that airstrike could be in the center of the city very easily. I mean, they were in the center of the city last year. And so it's really the unknown, you know. So you take a risk as a journalist going into any war zone, even if there's not active fighting, because sometimes you have to cross front lines. Sometimes there is a bombing where you didn't expect there to be. Sometimes you run across bandits on the road. And abduction, of course, is huge now because people have realized that they can kidnap Westerners and sell them and start to make money.
You have spoken at length about your own kidnappings, in particular your second kidnapping, which happened in Libya in 2011. There was also one in 2004, I believe, in Iraq.
Correct.
As fighting between pro and anti-Gaddafi forces raged in the eastern city of Ajdabiya in mid-March, four New York Times journalists and their driver were seized at a government military checkpoint. The four, reporter Anthony Shadid, reporter and videographer Stephen Farrell, and photographers Lindsay Adario and Tyler Hicks, were held captive for 6 days, often beaten and abused. After multi-nation negotiations, they were released on March 21st into the custody of Turkish diplomats. Their driver, Mohammed Shagluf, is still missing.
It seems strange to even ask this question, but did your first kidnapping prepare you for your second?
I hope my mother's not listening. Yes, it did, actually. And I think not only my first kidnapping, but I think the sort of years of experience of working in hostile situations and situations where, you know, a lot about being a journalist and a photographer is managing people's adrenaline and tempers and their anger and sort of trying to calm a situation down. And so I think we were very lucky in Libya because all of us, Anthony Shadid, Stephen Farrell, Tyler Hicks, and myself, we had extensive experience in war zones. And so we all knew to just keep our mouths shut, be quiet, be submissive, do whatever they told us to do, and not fight back. Because I think the main thing about being in captivity is that you have no power, and you cannot ask anything, you can't demand anything. You should keep your mouth shut and do whatever they say. And I think had any one of us started, you know, fighting back or saying, "Hey, we're journalists or we're American or whatever," then it could have gone really bad.
You were released after, I think, 5 days in captivity, but you've said that until you crossed the border, I think into Tunisia.
Correct. And it was 6 days.
6 days.
And every day counts.
Of course. You didn't think you were going to make it out alive. And you've also talked about at times in sort of quick moments of being in conflict and of doing your work in conflict, of thinking you were going to die. How, just as a human are you able to kind of reconcile your life in those moments? Are you able, is there any kind of peace in those moments? Or is it always a kind of desperate straining for life? And the characterization feels like it would be different to me in a moment of conflict versus a moment where you're sitting in a cell for 4, 5, 6 days thinking this could be the end. Is there a kind of meditative quality that one goes through?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's exactly right. There's a huge meditative quality. And, you know, people underestimate the ability or the strength of the survival mode that one goes into when confronted with death. And so for me, I was very zen, weirdly, when I was sort of lying face down in the dirt, had a gun put to my head, and I was literally staring down the barrel of a gun, trying to muster enough sort of saliva in my mouth to say please and to beg for my life. But I think, you know, in that moment, I was weirdly very calm because there was nothing I could do. You know, all I could do was beg for my life. And, you know, we were very lucky because in that moment they said, a commander came over and said, you can't kill them, they're American. And so they stopped and they then tied us up and carried us away. And it went on from there. But I think, you know, the entire time and every time I'm confronted with this possibility that, okay, this might be it, I get very focused and things get slow and almost calm because I'm trying to figure out what can I do to stay alive. And so there is nothing else aside from the fact that I'm saying, you know, oh, I hope I don't die and I hope I see my family again and I hope my cameras survive and I hope, you know, my pictures make it. There's a series, of course, of thoughts that go through my head that make no sense in that moment. But it's very much about being calm and focused and trying to stay alive.
I was just listening to an interview with you where you talk about the toolkit. It's kind of a metaphoric toolkit that you have. I mean, there's a literal one too, but that you and I guess probably a handful of other photojournalists have a certain set of skills about how to cover a war and how to stay alive. What is the biggest sort of single lesson about how to stay alive in a situation most of us will hopefully never find ourselves, but in a war, in a conflict like that?
I think it's listening to the locals, listening to whoever my driver is or translator. They can pick up on signals that I can't necessarily pick up on. I often don't speak the language. They can read body language in a way that I can't if it's a new culture or a new country I'm working in. And so I think the number one rule is listening to the people I'm working with.
What if you are a local? Have you picked up anything from the locals themselves about in from conflict to conflict about how they have survived? Is there a running?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's often their lives that are lost. You know, I mean, so many local journalists, drivers, translators are killed. And we're looking exactly at that case now with the Saudi journalist Khashoggi, because a lot of governments act with impunity and kill local journalists and no one really says anything. It kind of gets brushed under the rug. And I think that that's sort of a miscalculation the Saudis made, the royal family, when, the evidence points to the fact that it was ordered by MBS. But I think, you know, he probably thought, well, it's only a journalist. I can just brush it under the rug. And when we have a president who says, you know, journalists are the enemy of the people, he probably assumed he would get support from President Trump, which he hasn't really gotten condemned yet. And it's been almost 3 weeks. So I think, you know, it's often the locals that pay the price that we as foreigners are able to escape.
Listeners, think about this for a minute. Imagine you had a job where you said to yourself regularly, this might be it. What can I do to stay alive? I hope I don't die. I hope I see my family again. I mean, that kind of puts your coworker stealing your lunch from the fridge in perspective. Lindsay Addario has photo-documented almost every major theater of war in the 21st century, as well as horrific humanitarian crises and famines, among many other disturbing events. Her photos are beautiful, joyful, sad, and especially in this current climate, very important. Up next, we talk more about some of her experiences facing danger, how she learned to be a photographer, and how she has managed to stay so seemingly normal and sane despite everything she's seen. You grew up in Westport, Connecticut, which is I guess when you grew up there, it wasn't quite so Tony as it is now, probably, but still kind of a Tony
no.
area.
Yeah.
Your parents were, or maybe still are, hairdressers. And one of the things that you talk about with growing up in that household was the respect that they imbued in you for all kinds of people and being non-judgmental. And it occurred to me to ask, are you able to bring that level of non-judgment to people with whom you may have terrible disagreements in your work? So when you're covering the Taliban, for example, can you approach the Taliban with that same level of non-judgment as you can for maybe the women living under the Taliban?
Yeah, I mean, I have to. That is what it is to be a journalist. I mean, very often I'm covering people with whom I have nothing in common or I don't agree with their points of view, but I cover them and I try to do that fairly. I try to, you know, get their exact quotes and take their photograph in a way that doesn't sensationalize or doesn't, you know, that is sort of reality. And so that is part of being a journalist. And so, yeah, I'm in that situation all the time. And I definitely feel like my upbringing, the household in which I was raised, and the fact that my family sort of really opened up me and my three sisters to any walk of life and being open to people who are very different from us and to be non-judgmental. And I bring that with me everywhere I go and every story I work on.
One of the stories you've talked about is essentially being embedded with American forces in, forgive me if I'm getting the name wrong, Cornwall Valley in Afghanistan.
Korngal Valley.
And I'm going to start with a fairly pedestrian question because I don't know the answer to this. I've heard you describe how you guys had to jump out of Black Hawk helicopters to get into the Korngal Valley. How did you know how to jump out of a Black Hawk helicopter?
Okay, so to get into the Korngal Valley, you didn't have to jump out of a Black Hawk. So to get in, there were either Chinooks or Black Hawks that went and took us to the Korngal outpost, which was the main base that we were stationed at. And then there was an operation at the end of the 2 months where I was embedded with Elizabeth Rubin for the New York Times Magazine. Sebastian Younger came in and out, and Tim Hetherington, the late photographer, and Balázs Gárdi, who's a Hungarian photographer. So we, the sort of the five of us, were in and out for over the course of the several months. And at the end of the 2 months, we were gearing up for this Operation Rock Avalanche, which was a battalion-wide operation where we would go into sort of the heart of the insurgency in the middle of the night. And obviously people can hear the sound of helicopters, but the helicopters, the Black Hawks, would hover at about maybe 10 or 11 feet. And so we just literally... they don't teach you anything. We had our packs on our backs. I had my cameras out. It's pitch black. I'm wearing night vision goggles, which I don't know if any of the listeners have ever worn night vision goggles, but the depth perception is very difficult. And I'm scared for my life. And of course, like, everyone's just sort of pushing you out because I have like 10 guys behind me who also need to jump out. And so I just sort of hoped that I wouldn't land on my cameras and break a bone. And you just do it because you have no option.
We flew in the middle of the night. Guess what? They're not quiet helicopters that we fly. The enemy's awake now. What the fuck are the Americans doing flying over us right now? So now everybody's on the radios, I'm sure. You know, hey, the Americans are heading this way. So we got on the ground and we were already being told, be on alert, you know, everybody knows we're here.
I mean, so much about being embedded with the military is you do what you're told. So I think, you know, for me, no one ever taught me.
So it wasn't so much jumping out as falling out of a Black Hawk and hoping that nothing breaks.
Pretty much. I mean, look, I mean, it was only like 10, 11 feet. It wasn't like I was parachuting out, you know. But it was terrifying because we knew we were jumping literally into like the heart of the Taliban and that it was pitch black and we were landing on the side of a mountain. And of course, we all landed in like a giant pile and I had like people on top of me and I was sure my cameras were broken from the second I landed. But my durable Nikons.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just, there's such a kind of gorgeous inelegance in what you're talking about because it's so human. Just this idea yeah. of essentially a bunch of dudes and photographers and journalists falling out of a Black Hawk in the middle of the night and just kind of landing in a heap on the side of a mountain, hoping everybody's cool. I mean, it's just so kind of inelegant and unromantic in terms of what we think of when we think of like military preparedness.
I mean, I'll tell you a secret, like most of what we're doing is completely inelegant. You know, I mean, it's like Keystone Cops sometimes.
That's one of the things that I like a lot about your photographs, actually, is and you kind of described this a few minutes ago. The photographs themselves are often, for lack of a better word, unromantic. They show a kind of recognizable human existence. There's a sense sometimes that it feels kind of uncomposed, but in a very composed way. Like you feel like you understand that moment in that time with a real clarity because it's so recognizable. How did you find that? How did you find your photographer's eye?
Oh, well, I think it has evolved over many years. I think when I first started, I was very young. I was 12 or 13. But, you know, so for many years, I was just sort of playing with the camera at home and trying to figure out how to learn how to photograph. But it wasn't until the late 90s when I moved back to New York City to try and become a photographer. And so I had been living in Argentina and freelancing for the Buenos Aires Herald. I came back to New York with sort of a book of clips. And I marched into the Associated Press and was like, you know, I want to work for you. And of course, I had very little experience. And they were getting 50 freelancers a day, probably going in there saying they wanted a job. And Joan Rosen, who was the Northeast regional editor at the time, still tells a story of how she sort of looked at me and laughed and was like, she knew that I wouldn't take no for an answer. And I was very lucky because they did allow me to start freelancing for them. And I had some of the best mentors. I had Bibito Matthews, who was incredible. I mean, every Saturday he used to send me out on assignment, bring me back into the newsroom, look at my negative strip on the light table and say, like, get closer, you're too far, throw away your flash, look for the light, be patient, you're too impatient, and essentially, like, honed my eye over 3 years. And so those 3 years really, for me, helped shape my vision and how I approach subjects.
I read that you saw an exhibition of Sebastião Salgado, the Brazilian photographer. And can you describe what it was about those photographs that inspired you in that moment? It sounded like it was a moment where you needed to see them.
Yeah. I mean, so I had been living in Argentina and Buenos Aires, and I was trying to photograph for the Buenos Aires Herald, and I was shooting, you know, press conferences and the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo, and, you know, just trying to figure out how to be a photographer, what made a good photograph. I mean, I didn't really know. And so I had heard that there was an exhibition of Sebastião Salgado's, and I went, and the images were sort of wall size. They were massive prints, black and white prints of workers and the workers' faces in the mines where they were working. And there was something about the images that he was able to capture the soul, sort of the people he was photographing, and the sweat and the emotion and the sort of the beauty at the same time. So it was like this combination of these devastating images because the people were almost like machinery. They were blending into the, like, sort of the landscape. And he was able to make a beautiful, powerful, emotional sad, compelling image all in one. And to me, it was like, that is photography. That is the power of photojournalism. And that was the moment where I felt, wow, if I could ever do that with an image one day, I would be so proud and so honored. And that's all I wanted to do in that moment. You know, I really followed in his footsteps in a way that I wasn't cognizant of at the time. You know, he was covering Rwanda, genocide, Congo, the refugees. I mean, refugees. It's like, you know, that has been the topic of refugees and people fleeing for their lives, whether it's across the Mediterranean or if I'm doing Syrian refugees, or that refugees has become a sort of very important part of my body of work because I keep going back to that. I find refugees a natural and devastating consequence of war. And so, you know, I think it's important to cover them.
So when you look at these migrants who are trekking up through Mexico to come to the United States of America, mm-hmm. and we're recording October of 2018, so this is a current problem and probably a recurrent mm-hmm. problem. What do you see there and what how are we witnessing the same kinds of people coming up through Mexico as you see being displaced all over the world? I'm asking this terribly, so maybe I'll ask a different question.
I mean, I can kind of answer that.
Okay.
I understand what you're asking. I mean, I understand what you're getting to. I mean, I think, look, there is a caravan of I don't know how many thousands of people making their way up to the United States right now. And I think what we all need to do is look at the individuals within that caravan as to what it takes to flee your home with a child on your back and a child at your feet, and to walk and to make your way however you're making through rivers, whatever it is, to get to a place where you feel is safe enough to live. And I think there is a sheer desperation that we as most Americans can't conceive of. Because we happen to live in a country that for now there's stability. You know, there's some semblance, you know, we have a working government that provides for the people. We have an infrastructure. And a lot of those things don't exist elsewhere. So I think rather than look at this sort of group of refugees or migrants or whatever we're calling them these days, I think, you know, it's important to look at the people in there as people fleeing for their lives or people who obviously feel endangered enough to try to make their way to a place where they know they're unwelcome because President Trump has made it very clear.
You have a now, I think, 7-year-old son.
Mm-hmm. Almost seven.
Almost seven. If he comes to you in 10 years and says, Mom, I want to enlist, how would you feel about that?
First of all, I don't even let him go to the playground. So, I mean, I thought you were going to say if he comes to me and says I want to be a photojournalist.
No, because I feel like I know what you would say about that. I feel like you'd be supportive of that.
Really?
Well,
I mean, you know, I'm glad.
Judging by what I know
about
you and your devotion to your own work, if your son were to come to you with that same devotion, I'm purely surmising here, you wouldn't stand in that child's way. But if it were slightly different, this is why I asked it the way I asked it. If it were a slightly different thing where that your son was asking with a similar devotion to be a part of this machinery, which you have observed up close and personal, and as you said, sometimes it's Keystone Cops, and sometimes you're going in for noble reasons, and sometimes you're going in for less than noble reasons. Would you be cool mm-hmm. with your son signing that dotted line?
I'd have to be. You know, I mean, the thing that has given me, that has empowered me most as a woman, as a person, as a photographer, is the fact that my parents gave me that freedom to do what I felt I needed to do and let me find my own path. And I very luckily found it very early on, and it's something that I that my passion has not faded. But I have to let my son do what he believes in. Of course, my approach would be to do what my husband does to me when I come to him and say, I want to go to Yemen. And that is, he poses a series of questions to me. Why do you need to be there? What can you contribute? What is the goal? What's the end game? And so I think my role as a mother would be to, you know, make sure that he's thought it through, that there's a reason that he's not doing it for, you know, for lack of any other direction. And so I would probably ask him a lot of questions, but ultimately, I can't stop my son from doing what he believes in because my parents always backed me on every single thing I believed in.
Having witnessed what you've witnessed over the years that you've witnessed it, are you able to deal with that weird dichotomy? I mean, when you come home from Yemen and you're back in New York or wherever you are, how do you make that mental adjustment to life as normal?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's not so easy. Sometimes, you know, I think over time, of course, I've developed the tools to move between these worlds. But sometimes there's such a stark difference between, you know, going from Yemen and 2 days later landing in New York City and, you know, going out to the Hamptons to photograph a wedding. You know, I think there's that was within the span of 72 hours. So that's crazy. You know, I mean, that the difference in those worlds
it's crazy
is,
that you do wedding
is
photography.
Extraordinary.
I mean, that's the craziest thing.
I don't. It was a friend. I don't. It was a gift for a friend. But I think that I've sort of learned to just navigate those worlds by being very present in the moment wherever I am. And so I try to do that. And I find it's worked. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable literally from one day to the next being in completely different situations.
Have you suffered any mental health problems from living, in trauma? I mean, you've been kidnapped twice. And then also just witnessing what you've witnessed.
I'm sure I have suffered from PTSD, it would be almost impossible given what I've been through, not only the kidnappings, but also two drivers have died working with me. Raza in Pakistan, when we were covering the Taliban invasion in Swat Valley, and we were leaving, and my driver, Raza, fell asleep at the wheel. And I was thrown out of a car on a highway and he died. And so even though, you know, he fell asleep at the wheel, I felt guilty for a long time. And so how does that manifest? I think the only time in my life where I said, this is a direct result from my work and I have symptoms of PTSD was right after the Korangal Valley, after Operation Rock Avalanche. And, you know, we had been living in such a heightened state of adrenaline and fear and, you know, this rush all the time for almost 2 months of being shot at and mortared and 7-hour-a-day patrols and, you know, and then doing this operation where we were eventually ambushed by the Taliban and hit from three sides and three soldiers were shot. And at the end of that, I had a very difficult time re-entering into my life. I couldn't stop crying. I would be at a dinner with friends and have to excuse myself and go to the bathroom and was sort of convulsing and crying and I couldn't sleep. But that passed after a few months, to be honest. And after Libya, very strangely, I felt so lucky to be alive. Once we crossed into Tunisia and after when I went back to India where I was living and then came to New York, that I felt okay. And it wasn't until I got news that Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros, who were both friends, were killed in Libya a month after we were released, that I had a complete meltdown. And I think that was survivor's guilt. I think that it was really about why did we live and they died? I couldn't understand how that worked, who decides fate. And so I had a very hard time and I sort of pulled back and was trying to process. And, you know, I'm very lucky because I have an incredible family, a very solid foundation. I have my husband, I have my sisters, my mother, my father, Bruce. I have people in my life that I can talk to very openly and feel very comfortable and protected with them. And I think that that contributes to why I'm still relatively okay, despite everything I've been through.
Well, Lindsay Addario, as our hour winds up, I end each episode of How to Be Amazing with something called the Amazing Five, in which I will ask for a recommendation in each of five categories. And this will hopefully be a little bit more fun than PTSD talk. And I'll start with the funnest of all, food. From all your travels all over the world, is there some food that you love, that you discovered, that you would recommend to others?
I'm so boring. I mean, I usually when I'm working, I'm so worried about getting sick because I don't have time to get sick that I eat like boiled eggs and bananas and protein bars. I guess Japan was the one place where I really went for it, but I don't remember one specific thing, but I just love Japanese food. So I'm afraid I'm not very amazing. I mean, Sicily. I did a long stint in Sicily because I was covering the migrant crisis, and wow, but I just got fat, so.
Yeah, but that must mean the food was very good.
It was incredible.
Music. What kind of music do you listen to?
Oh, so there are two things. So when I'm coming off of an intense assignment, I always listen to Bach, the cello suites by Yo-Yo Ma, as like a decompression. So I usually sit on the plane and put on my headphones, and that's what I listen to. And it has it. I fall asleep pretty much almost within 10 minutes every time I do that. And then when I'm home, I listen to a lot of sort of female acoustic mellow music, or I listen to old jazz like Nina Simone and Ella Fitzgerald and like that.
Do you get a per diem when you're in a war zone?
No, you get... That's funny. I mean, some places you couldn't spend $60.
I was going to say, like, what do you even spend $60 on, like, when you're in war?
Well, I mean, look, sometimes it's super expensive because there is no food, so you pay a lot. No, basically the way it works, I get a day rate and then I get my expenses are covered. But you can't, alcohol is not covered, but I work in the Muslim world pretty often, so that's not usually an issue.
Right. Just a practical, but just a practical question that sprang to my mind. Film or television?
I've been watching TV series. I finally saw The Americans.
It took
me 6 years. But I finally started watching The Americans,
it's good,
which
right?
I became obsessed with. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
I had the biggest crush on Keri Russell when I was in my early 20s. And she was on a show called Malibu Shores. And I was just with my girlfriend, now wife. And then, like, the biggest thrill was I got to have lunch with her once, like, maybe 5 years later. And to this day, my wife will not let it go that I had a crush on Keri Russell.
That's funny. I mean, The Handmaid's Tale. I think that The Handmaid's Tale is great. Mm-hmm. I've been watching that. I have a huge crush on Max Minghella. Mm-hmm. He's adorable. He's, like, half my age, but adorable. The Night Of was amazing. I watched that. So a lot of series. Killing Eve. I mean, they're all like about assassins and killing, which is kind of depressing.
Yeah. A book you would recommend.
I think a Joan Didion book, maybe. I just think that Joan Didion or James Salter was always, I used to read A Sport and a Pastime. Sort of go back to it for the beautiful writing. Ray Carver. There's not one. I just like to sort of dip in and out of books, actually, annoyingly.
Yeah. You're a dipper, a book dipper.
Yeah, I'm a book dipper.
And then finally, miscellaneous, anything from your life that you love that you would recommend to others? Any sort of thing that gives you comfort or joy?
I mean, this sounds completely insane, but I love like my hour at the gym every day. Mm. It's what keeps me sane.
That doesn't sound...
I think that it's what keeps me like happy and balanced and feeling good and energetic and meditative, and I listen to music and I love it.
What is your workout routine?
So when I'm in London, I do reformer Pilates. Mm-hmm. Like the Pilates on those machines, because I have a back problem. So I'm sort of religious about doing those classes, and that has changed my life, because for the first time in 7 years, I'm pain-free, which is incredible. And I think when I'm here in New York, I just go to the New York Sports Club and do like the ARC trainer.
Oh. Well, Lindsay Addario, thank you for taking the time and coming on, and thank you for all your work helping all of us understand things that are so far beyond what our day-to-day life is like, and shining a light on all of those issues, good and bad. And thank you for being amazing.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor.
How to Be Amazing is brought to you by PRX. Like How to Be Amazing on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @HTBA_show, and check out our website at howtobeamazingshow.com. If you like what you've heard, please write us a nice review on iTunes. How to Be Amazing is produced by Jennifer Brennan and Mary Shimkin. It's recorded at Argo Studio in New York City. Today's show is mixed and edited by Robin Lynn, with music composed by Chad Crouch. I'm Michael Ian Black.